Good morning, everyone. Welcome to the Bible study. I'd like to talk about something this morning that hopefully won't put you to sleep. I think it's a term you've heard before, and some thoughts that are hopefully very clearly ingrained in your minds. What I'd like to talk about is the doctrine of non-resistance. How many of you have ever heard of that doctrine? All right. So before you drift off to sleep, we're going to spend some time talking about non-resistance, what we believe about it, why we believe some of those things, and then hopefully next week, and maybe this week, hopefully the whole thing is practical, but I do want to become rather practical toward the end, thinking about how we can live as non-resistant Christians. We all say we've heard about non-resistant. I'm sure we'd all say we are non-resistant. But let's study this together. I'm looking forward to it. I had to think of something, thinking about this subject. I thought about two things. One was at Bible school. The first year at the Bible school I went to, you were required to take a course on non-resistance and, I believe, a course on separation. Those were, or unless it was one the 1 year, and if it came again the next year, it was the other one. And those were two, so I think they are sort of two basic Anabaptist doctrines. The other thing I thought about in connection to Bible school was a Bible school teacher that I had. I'm not sure if he taught this or not, but he had one of these, a stand. And in this case, he would have brought it back a couple more benches. He always said he had to go to where the people were. So I thought of that when I brought this down this morning as I was thinking about Bible school. So speaking of non-resistance, what comes to your mind? What do you think about? We've all heard about it. We all know about it. I think we all are non-resistant. So what does that mean to you? All right. That's probably one of the first things we think of. We don't go to war. What else? Joseph? All right. We don't give back evil. We don't return evil for evil. Very good. What else? I'm not after a certain thing. I'm after whatever you're thinking. What comes to your mind when you think of non-resistance?
It takes the role of the poor and the rejected. And, Matthew 5, verse 3 comes to mind. Blessed are the poor in spirit, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven.
All right. So you're saying that if someone's non-resistant, they're liable to be, they're defenseless, or they're helpless. But it's really those kind of people that inherit heaven. All right? Anything else? Are most of your neighbors non-resistant? I guess depending where you live. Maybe Ibra's neighbors. Are most of your neighbors non-resistant? So I guess what I'm getting at here is, if you're non-resistant, are half the people in the world non-resistant? Or are most people? Or are you a minority, a very small minority? Ray.
We're definitely a minority. Even in Christendom, I think we're a minority. Mm-hmm. Or if we are non-resistant, we are anyways.
Right. Okay. Is there any other denomination that across the board would teach non-resistance other than, you know, Anabaptist, Mennonite? Henry?
I know Jehovah's Witnesses believe in non-resistance, but they may not be a Orthodox Christian, okay. Obviously.
I was not aware of that. What do they they believe like we do?
Basically, yeah. I had them come to my door, and they basically believe they don't want to go to war. I think I would agree with what they believe in non-resistance.
Okay. I was not aware of that. I used to work with a Jehovah's Witness, and I don't think he was super non-resistant, but there's probably different levels of it, and that's new to me. Is there any other denominations you can think of that are non-resistant? Up front here, up to Clarence.
I was just asking my wife, we have a book of, I don't know how many are aware here today, back during the Second World War, there was a camp up in Northern Ontario by a place called Montreal River, where the young men that would have been enlisted to the army could go to do their time. I'm trying to rack my brain what the name of it is, or what it was called.
CPS camps?
Pardon?
CPS camps?
Something to that effect, yeah. Alternate service, I believe it was called to that. But in this book that we have of that, Vera's father was up there. My dad was too old at that timeline, but my uncle, my dad's brother, was up there. And in this book that we got just recently, at the back end of it, there's a list of different denominations that were represented up there. And when I looked through it, I was actually quite surprised. Like, obviously, the Mennonites were there, the Amish were there, but there's some Pentecostals, mm-hmm. there's some Jehovah's Witness, there's some, if I can get this name out right, Christophanian, or something to that effect, and the odd Baptist. I think some of these wasn't like a denominational stand. Some of them maybe it was more individual. Mm-hmm. But it's an interesting book to go through.
And is that a book that was written in the last 10 years, or is it one that was written 50 years
yes,
ago?
Yes, it was just on the last 10 years. Okay. It's a historical account, basically, of that camp up there,
okay.
listing many, I don't know, of all the names of the young men that were up there.
Mm-hmm. I see. Interesting. How many of you are familiar with a book called Glimpses of Mennonite History and Doctrine? It's written by John Christian Wenger. You are, Alvin? What's that? Yeah. It's an interesting book, and a lot of it, J.C. Wenger was a very schooled Mennonite. I believe he was a professor at one of the Mennonite universities, either Goshen or Eastern Mennonite College. I'm not sure which one. And his books are really good, and I would recommend, if you see any of them, get them. But this one spends a fair bit of time talking about the early Christians, and it's not just non-resistance, it's history, Glimpses of Mennonite History and Doctrine. And it evaluates sort of what some of the early Christians believed, and I may talk about, I'm planning to read a few snippets out of it next week. But he died in, I'm not sure when he died, but he wrote this book in the 50s, I would say. And so he had an interesting article on the Mennonites in Europe and their view toward non-resistance. And since the late 1800s, the Mennonites in Germany, it says very few of them, you know, had any problem with non-resistance, but officially, early 1900s, the Mennonites in Germany had lost it. I think they all went to war. In Holland, same thing. And he went through each country in Europe and just told how the Mennonites, you know, our forefathers, as a large part of us anyhow, have basically almost 100% lost it in Europe. All right, so a non-resistant position is certainly the minority. Actually, he went on to say in the 50s that the Mennonites in Germany, and we never hear about Mennonites in Germany, but he obviously knew about Mennonites in Germany in the 50s. He said they have almost zero tolerance for anyone that is non-resistant. You know, the Mennonites, sometimes we look at people that are more conservative than us. Maybe they believe something slightly different than we do. Or maybe it's something that, I think you know what I mean. And we have a little bit of sympathy to it. We say, well, I don't do that. This is why I don't do it. But we're sympathetic. We know the thought process. Well, the Mennonites in Germany in the 50s were so far removed from that that they even have no sympathy for someone that was non-resistant. Another thing that I heard a lot growing up, and I'm going to just raise it, I'm just curious what you think, is I heard, and we would have been taught, that separation and non-resistance are tied together. And name a group that has lost one and held on to the other. And that's something to think about. I think when you think about the Mennonites in Europe, I'm not sure which they lost first, but I think they've lost both. Think about another group. Is there an exception to that rule? I'm not sure. And that's not a real important question. But it's something interesting to think about. So if Christendom as a whole does not believe this, are they wrong or are we wrong? Or are we just taking the safe approach? Is there a biblical basis for non-resistance, I guess is what I'm saying. Is it something that's important, or is it something that, you know, it's sort of okay to do, but if you don't want to, then that's fine too. And that leads into the next little thing that I'd like to do. I'd like to write down I'm calling it principles of non-resistance, or biblical teachings that back up our belief. What are they? And I'm gonna just sort of write them down as they come. What are some biblical reasons that you are non-resistant? George?
I was thinking of the verse where Jesus said, love your enemies, bless them that curse you, do good to them that hate you, and I couldn't quite find the verse, but I think it's in Matthew 5 somewhere,
right.
Verse 6.
It's Matthew 5 later on in the chapter. All right, so what principles are listed that did George mention? The first one that I would write down as a sort of, we can think about specific verses, and in some cases, it's just sort of the New Testament. So it actually came out in what George talked about. What is sort of a New Testament principle that is completely contrary to resisting or to fighting back? Love. There are so many references all over the Bible to love that I think if there was no other verses about don't resist, resist not evil, and things like that, you know, I think we would be bound to this. George also mentioned another one that I believe is a reason that we practice non-resistance. What other verse did he mention? If you want to, you can turn to Matthew 5, and I believe it's 38 to, it's close to the end of the chapter, 38 to 46. So what else do you find?
Blessing.
Blessing instead of cursing, all right? That's sort of like love. That's not the one I was after. There's another one. Right in there. And it's you're maybe trying to say it. But the whole principle of returning good for evil, right? What's that? All right. So someone does evil to you, you bless them instead, or you pray for them, or you give them something good. I'm just going to write return good for evil. What else? What other reasons do we practice non-resistance? All right. Long suffering. So you read a few others. You read one other one in particular, Clarence. That's closely connected to that. Peace. Ever hear of, God's kingdom of peace? And doesn't that just that whole concept of peace is completely against resisting. Should learn how to count. Anything else? All right. Love, charity.
But I think there's a difference in love and charity. One I could create words to explain the difference. Charity and giving.
All right. I think love is giving too. But no, I think we know true Christian love or true Christian charity, however you want to explain that, is clearly all over the Bible, all over the New Testament. What other principles are there? Reasons that we believe in non-resistance. Ray?
I don't know if there's a principle. I mean, the principles already mentioned are embodied in this passage, but a passage I always think of is when Jesus was arrested and Peter came out swinging with his sword, and Jesus told him, stop it, put the sword away, and then he added, don't you know those who live by the sword will also die by the sword?
All right, I had that one. Thank you, Ray. All right, that's in the Bible. Those that live by the sword will die by the sword. Can you hold your thought for 1 second? Thinking of that, were you going to talk about this, George? Okay. There's some interesting history. The Mennonites in Russia held their non-resistance longer than the Mennonites in some of the other parts of Europe. But during the communist takeover or the First World War, at some point there, they were still teaching non-resistance. Some men were joining the army, others were not. But the teaching was still there, don't join the army, don't resist. And a group of, and these Mennonites went through terrible suffering. They were wealthy. They were German, and they were wealthy. And in Russia, as you know, the Russians were fighting against the Germans. The Germans were trying to take over the world. And so Germans were not popular anywhere else. And so these people were wealthy. They were German. You know, unfortunately, they also, some of them had not shown Christian love to their Russian neighbors. But at any rate, as the Russians, as the communists started coming in and taking their goods and plundering what they had, you know, it was too much for some of them. And it, trust me, all of us would be tested. And I'm not sure how we would, I'm not sure how I would respond if someone came in and, you know, took all my stuff and I just sat there. And they did it not just to me, but to everyone else in my community. You know, the feelings of animosity would certainly be there. Anyhow, these Russian Mennonite young men in Russia formed a little rebellion. And, you know, I think it was effective until the powers that be caught onto it. And as you can imagine, a little army of Mennonite boys was really no match for the Russian army. And what happened after that is they were defeated soundly. And then the real misery began. Then the army came in with force. Now, maybe they would have anyhow, but it goes to the point, you live by the sword, you'll die by the sword. Sorry, George.
I was just thinking of selfishness, and I don't know if that would fit in, because the scriptures teach against selfishness.
All right.
That may be a sub point there somewhere.
Okay, so thinking of the principle of non-resistant, what's the opposite of selfishness? Generosity. And that's actually shown in Matthew 5. That is a principle in the New Testament. All right. Any other principles that you can think of? That sort of govern our thoughts on non-resistance.
I'm not sure how this fits into it, but I always think of the teaching that we're not to judge, and I always feel if, let's say, we take up arms and we'd go to war and start killing people, in a sense, we're taking judgment into our own hands, and it's again, something we're taught in the Bible not to do.
All right. Yes, that's right. I'm trying to think how I could write that in there. How could we rephrase that or clarify that? Wayne.
I think the Bible talks about the vengeance being the Lord's.
All right. Vengeance is God's, that's right. And that is that close enough? All right, vengeance is God's. There's another sort of important one. Abe?
This may not be what you're thinking, but John 18:36, Jesus answered, "My kingdom is not of this world. If my kingdom were of this world, then would my servants fight." And then he goes on, that I should not be delivered to the Jews. But now is my kingdom not from hence. So one good reason not to fight is because this is not our home.
Thanks, Abe. That's exactly what I was thinking of. And we're going to talk about that a little bit more when we talk about war. But that's a principle that guides our belief on non-resistance. My kingdom is not of this world. Turn to Matthew 10, verse 16. Behold, I send you forth as sheep in the midst of wolves. Be ye therefore wise as serpents, harmless as doves. So another principle that I wrote down is we're sheep in the midst of wolves. We're helpless. All right. There is another sort of big and sort of clear Bible command that I need to get yet. I think Ray's going to share it.
I just had a quick thought. Sometimes when we're sheep in the midst of wolves, I think it's important to remember that sheep's protection, like it's not like they have no protection whatsoever.
Right.
They have a shepherd.
That's right. They have a shepherd. Good point. And we're actually going to talk about later on, and I think it's going to be next week, about, and you can think about this, about how sheep can survive. We talked about us being the minority. So how can sheep survive in the midst of wolves? So as a Christian, as a non-resistant Christian, is there a certain way you need to live your life? Is there things you should do? Is there things you shouldn't do? Think about that, and we want to talk about that next week. That relates to us. All right. There's still one big one missing. Very, very clear Bible command, Paul. That no one said. I think we've sort of implied it maybe, but
this isn't maybe what you're looking for, a Bible command, but there's it's what you just said, and back several of the points that have been touched on. It's just trust in God or in the sovereignty of God that He is a righteous judge.
Mm-hmm.
And He'll recompense and He can turn evil for good. And there's so many examples of that. If you think of a shepherd, well, if we just simply trust our shepherd, He's all-powerful. We're just but sheep. And just that confidence and trust in a sovereign God. I was just reading this morning about Daniel, and there's so many other examples. They trusted their lives, even their souls. Peter talks about that He is able to keep our souls.
All right.
And it's just that really knowing God as our Father, as our shepherd, as a sovereign judge of all the earth, just that confident trust that if we're taking advantage of, I often think this, you know, sometimes we get ripped off on a deal or somebody doesn't pay, but God is so much greater than we are.
Mm-hmm.
And He's able to turn that for good. And if we take a loss in one way, He can recompense that so much more another way if we just trust Him and mm-hmm. surrender to Him.
All right. Thank you for that, Paul. I don't think I spelled sovereignty right, but that's what it's supposed to say. The sovereignty of God. And that will come up again, but I do appreciate that.
Exodus 20, verse 13 says, "You shall not murder."
All right. Yes, you shall not murder. That is a principle from the Old Testament that has been clearly repeated in the New, hasn't it? It still stands. Ron.
I was thinking about that kingdom, and I don't know if this is what you're thinking, but we live in a different covenant altogether. The old covenant is over for the believer, and the new covenant is here. And that encapsulates and, you know, brings a lot of that. We are from heaven and not from this earth.
Right. Uh-huh. The whole new covenant and old covenant discussion, I think, is necessary for us to understand non-resistance for us today. There's no question it's necessary. We know that war was and we're going to talk about this later too. But we know that war was a big part of the Old Testament that God commanded. All right, let's turn to Matthew 5, the really big, obvious one you're all avoiding. We're going to get to it. Matthew 5, verse 38. So, look at what we've already come up with, and we've missed a big one, but principles of non-resistance, love, charity, return good for evil, long-suffering, God's kingdom of peace, those that live by the sword will die by the sword, generosity, vengeance is God's. My kingdom is not of this world. Sheep in the midst of wolves, sovereignty of God, you shall not murder. Do you think of it? Okay, we need the mic up here. Stephen.
Might it be turning the other cheek?
We sort of have that. That's tied in with the one we have, good, returning good for evil. But we'll get to it. Don't sweat. Okay, so Matthew 5, verse 38. So think about this list of things that we've written. Matthew 5, 38, Jesus is giving the Sermon on the Mount. Ye have heard that it hath been said, an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth. Was that said? Had anyone heard that before? Sure they had. That was part of the law. And how was that really what God intended? That if someone punches you, you punch them right back. Was that God's intent? I'm not, okay, don't misunderstand me here. God doesn't want sin. But if someone was to punch you in the Old Testament, what were you supposed to do, or what were you allowed to do? If he took out your tooth, you were to take out his tooth. You had every right to do that. Turn. What is that verse? I did write it down. Exodus 21, 23 to 25. Just turn there. I'm gonna read that. There's several things that sort of say the same thing, several passages. Exodus 21, 23. Actually, I'll start at 22. If men strive and hurt a woman with child so that her fruit depart from her, yet no mischief follow, he shall surely be punished, according as the woman's husband will lay upon him. He shall pay as the judge is determined. And if any mischief follow, then thou shalt give life for life, eye for eye, tooth for tooth, hand for hand, foot for foot, burning for burning, wound for wound, stripe for stripe. And it goes on to list other things that happen if different offenses take place. So, right in the law, freedom was given to retaliate. Jesus, and I believe no one questioned this. This was just a known fact that if someone steals your ox, his ox is killed. If your tooth gets knocked out, his tooth gets knocked out. If he kills my brother, I have the freedom to kill him. That was just a principle that of dealing with evil and repressing evil, I believe, that God had set up. And what was the value of that? Well, I think one value is that you knew if you were going to do something like that, you probably thought twice. You knew if they caught you, and you had just go to the extreme, you know that murder was going to be punished with murder. Today, I think a lot of people don't think about that, and I realize that when people are consumed by passion, they don't think about the consequences. But I believe it was God's way of repressing evil in the Old Testament. So Matthew 5, verse 38. You've heard that it hath been said, an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth. And that had certainly been clarified. And now the big one. But I say unto you that ye resist not evil. Don't resist evil. Just let evil go. When someone knocks your tooth out, what do you do to them? You don't resist evil. You pick one of the things on here and you do that to them. Can you imagine how the multitude, what do you think the multitude thought when Jesus got to verse 39? I'm not sure who was first, Ray?
I was actually going to try to be humorous, so maybe the other guy can straighten me out again, but I think the multitude thought this guy sure won't make a good civil leader.
Okay. I think so too. I think, yeah, I agree. Wayne.
I'm not sure if they heard the last one, so maybe it's the same. I'm not sure. But I think they were thinking that evil will prevail. Under those terms, evil will take over.
Okay. Or in other words, this is an impossible doctrine. Doesn't make any sense. I 100% agree. Matt?
I think back in Exodus, it's fairly clear that those laws were being set up, like it says. It makes mention of the judges. So I think it was fairly clear that was like the laws that the judges were to follow in making their judgments. I don't think it was giving permission to the one who got his tooth knocked out to just strike out and knock out the tooth of the other one. And I think Jesus was correcting that in what he was saying. The Jews had taken it that way, I think, and he was bringing it back and showing them that's not the way it was.
Okay, so, but really you're saying that the judges would have used the tooth knocked out, for example, if my tooth was knocked, if you knocked out my tooth, it maybe wasn't my freedom to attack you that instant, but we'd go to the judge, and the judge would give me freedom, or somebody would take out your tooth. That was clear in the Old Testament, wasn't it? Or are you saying that that wasn't the intent?
It might have been. I think the main principle is that the punishment wasn't to exceed the crime.
Okay. So if someone knocked out your tooth, you weren't allowed to kill him. For sure. But yet, the principle of an eye for an eye was there. And if someone took out your eye, his eye was next. And whether it was sanctioned by the judge, there was no call to love, correct? I don't think so. I don't think there was any requirement at all to love this man and to treat him kindly instead. All right, so this teaching of Jesus to resist not evil was completely contrary to anything I believe that these people had ever heard. They never heard that before. They never even thought of it, and it was impossible. How could that possibly work? And I think they had actually heard some more things like that so far in the chapter, but this is on the subject of non-resistance. Verse 40, and if any man will sue thee at the law and take away thy coat, let him have thy cloak also. And whosoever shall compel thee to go a mile, go with him twain. Can someone give me the background to that verse?
I understand that in Jesus' day, because the Romans were the prevailing authority, they were the civil government. At any time, a Roman citizen, actually, but Roman soldier, a Roman soldier could ask any one of his underlings to could compel him to carry his burden for a mile.
That's correct. And I think this is generally referring to the government requiring you to do something, and very, very clearly what Ray spoke about. So if a policeman would come to you and say, I want you to, you have your pickup, I want you to pull my trailer for 10 miles. Okay, you might say, doesn't really suit me now, but you don't have hatred toward the policeman, do you? I think we appreciate the work that the policemen do. This was different. The people that heard Jesus talking here had absolutely no time for this authority. These were the Romans. They hated the Romans. The Romans had taken over their holy land. The Romans were dogs. The Romans were ruthless. The Romans were unclean. They were Gentiles. They were uncircumcised, dirty, ugly, filthy Gentiles. And then a whole lot more. And the Jewish attitude towards the Romans was not very pleasant. And you can just imagine, there's things you can read that sort of explain how Jews felt toward Romans. But yet, they were forced. When a Roman soldier came along, no matter if you were the rabbi and you hated Romans with all of your heart, you had to carry his bag for 1 mile. You carried it for 1 mile, you dropped it down, you didn't have to go one inch further, and neither would you. Jesus was commanding them, you know what, you take that pack, you walk with a spring in your step, you get to the end of the 1 mile, you say, Mr. Soldier, I'd love to take it one more mile. I'm not sure how he felt when you told him that, but I think he was about as surprised as these people were. But that was the principle. So it's not just being kind to someone at church. This is about going the second mile with someone that I was going to say that you hate, but hopefully you don't hate anyone. This is about going the second mile to someone that really has taken advantage of you. Verse 42, give to him that asketh thee, and from him that would borrow of thee, turn not thou away. Ye have heard that it hath been said, thou shalt love thy neighbor and hate thine enemy. But I say unto you, love your enemies, bless them that curse you, do good to them that hate you, and pray for them which despitefully use you and persecute you, that ye may be the children of your Father which is in heaven. For he maketh his sun to rise on the evil and the good, and sendeth rain on the just and on the unjust. For if ye love them which love you, what reward have ye? Do not even the publicans the same? And I'll keep reading, actually. And if you salute your brethren only, what do ye more than others? Do not even the publicans so? Be ye therefore perfect, even as your Father which is in heaven is perfect. All right, those words are pretty clear, aren't they? Maybe while we're thinking about that, let's turn to a passage that is quite somewhat parallel, and that's Romans 12. It says a lot of the same things, to be honest. Romans 12, and I'm going to read verse 10, and then we will jump down to verse 17. Romans 12, verse 10, be kindly affectioned one to another with brotherly love, in honor preferring one another. Verse 17, recompense to no man evil for evil. Provide things honest in the sight of all men. If it be possible, as much as lieth in you, live peaceably with all men. Dearly beloved, avenge not yourselves, but rather give place unto wrath. For it is written, vengeance is mine, I will repay, saith the Lord. Therefore, if thine enemy hunger, feed him. If he thirst, give him drink. For in so doing, thou shalt heap coals of fire on his head. Be not overcome of evil, but overcome evil with good. Any questions? Is there something you don't understand about what we just read?
I'm going bald, but I'd prefer not to do it with blisters from burning coals.
All right. So you're questioning some of Jesus' terminology. But do you really question any of the principles that were listed here? I don't think we do. I don't think we don't need to get Strong's Concordance. We don't need to read it in another version. It's actually quite clear. And in my mind, there's really no contest. There's no question that these are clear words, first of all from Jesus, in this case from the Apostle Paul, but throughout the New Testament. Be kindly affectioned one to another. What does that mean? What could that possibly mean? Well, I think we know what that means. Be kindly affectioned. Maybe we don't know how to do it. Maybe we don't know how to do it like we should. Maybe, and truly, we're not always doing it like we should. But these words are so simple, and I find them refreshing. If you think about the world today, we think about the wars and the rumors of wars. We think about the animosity between racial groups. We think about even political parties and how they clash. And then we listen, and then we just read words like this. It's sort of like cool water washing over us, and it's refreshing. That's what I found as I read these verses, that all of them, it's such a wonderful way of life, such a wonderful, peaceful way that Jesus has certainly shown us an excellent way. And we, you know, we're so blessed and so happy if only we can follow it. All right. I think we're going to more or less close this down. Next week, just to get you thinking, is going to be a lot more practical. We're going to talk about why we don't go to war. And yes, we did talk about some of the reasons today. But we're going to sort of look at the first easy one, war. We're going to look at, and come with your questions. And I'm sure the group here will be able to answer them, not necessarily me. But we're going to look at, you know, should we be part of the police force? Can there be a Christian policeman? What about a labor union? We're going to talk about that. And actually, the whole union discussion is what drew me to this subject. So we're going to talk just briefly about labor unions. We're going to talk about going to law. We're going to talk about protesting. So if war is wrong, should we go to Ottawa and protest against the government? Should our church go there with big signs and say, you know, bring our soldiers home from Syria? Trudeau, bring our soldiers home from Syria. We could take a big microphone. We could shout it all over Parliament Hill. Should we do that? God doesn't like war, does he? And then we want to talk about sort of, at some point, the non-resistant lifestyle. We want to talk about reasons that people don't practice non-resistance. And connected to all of that, we want to talk about how we live, how should us as non-resistance Christians order our lives. And I will try to talk fast, try to get done next week, but as I go over this list of things, I have a feeling that it could go into the third week, but maybe not. Come with your questions. Let's make this a profitable discussion. God bless you, and that ends our class.